It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Last Week in Brexit is brought to you by Pearson Solicitors and Financial Advisors, helping businesses and families for over 100 years. And Greater Manchester Chambers of Commerce. Connect, communicate, create.
Hello and welcome to Last Week in Brexit, the podcast all about leaving the EU. Now, we've had a week off because we're rather smug and content with our last episode with Oliver Norgrove. But don't worry, because I am joined by our two usual contributors. Looking rather content is Alex Davis. Hello, Alex.
Hello.
And looking rather smug is Christian Spence.
Thank you for that. Hello.
Right, gents, let's just catch up with some of the more boring stuff. After all, we are a business podcast dealing with Brexit. So the two things that I wanted you to go over, you can do this in any way you want, is the impact of VAT, followed by the recent comments from the CBI.
Where do we start? The first thing to say is that not a lot is happening, really.
No.
In the month leading up to Christmas, not a lot seems to have happened. And since Christmas, not a lot seems to have happened. And a lot of the conversation... It's kind of good in a way, because a lot of the conversation has fallen back onto, you know, definitions of customs union. And you know, we're back to talking about the details, because... In terms of the politics and the Brexit process, it's just still at a standstill.
I think it's certainly a standstill publicly. Of course, I mean, there's quite a lot of background work going on hidden in the marble halls of the EU at the moment. Because of course, the last big thing we had was, you know, the UK finally got its phase one status through just before Christmas. That's now being worked on in detail, because people say, "Oh, we've got it." It's like, don't forget, we got sufficient progress. It's not done. There's still quite a lot of detail to flesh out, particularly around the Northern Ireland border, which was completely fudged. So, you know, our statements of intent are sufficient. So there's lots of paperwork going on that. And the EU is currently in the process of drafting its negotiation guidelines for Monsieur Barnier for phase two and transition. So all that's happening in the background. So we're not seeing a great deal. I think it's the 29th of January that the EU is due to publish its guidelines for Michel Barnier and his Task Force 50 on the transition process.
So are they updating their guidelines on a rolling basis now?
Well, they do it for each phase. So essentially, don't forget, the guidelines that were originally drawn up by the EU last year only covered getting us through to the first phase, essentially. Transition wasn't on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Transition, you know, the EU only agreed in December that we'll now talk about transition. The UK has asked for it, so the EU is now drawing up its guidelines. So they've got to get essentially the agreement of the 27 to what it is they have to agree to. They'll give all that to Barnier, and then off we go with the next round of talks.
You raise a good point, because I've actually seen someone tweeting today about some transition directives which have come out of the Commission, they've been called, and they make it very clear that the withdrawal stuff isn't sorted out. Just because we've got this, you know, in quotes, first phase agreement, it's really not sorted.
No, that's it.
And they've come back with some stricter requirements for citizens' rights.
Mm-hmm.
They basically told us that the current situation with regards to citizens' rights must be maintained up until the end of the transition period. So everything's got to basically stay the same.
Yeah, 31st of December 2020, that's when we expect. Because I think for the last year or so, probably a bit more, the assumption has been 2 years. Transition, so two calendar years, but the EU's budgeting cycle essentially runs out at the end of December 2020, so it's more likely to be that.
Different stuff on that, because I've seen that people are talking about it now only really until 2020.
Mm-hmm.
In the select committee today, David Davis got questioned was given some difficult questions by people like Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Well put.
Let's say. Yeah, he said that he expects the transition period to be between 21 and 27 months, so he's talking two years.
Plus. Well, 21 months would take you to the end of the end of December. Yeah, end of December 2020.
Just whilst you're on the select committee stuff,
yeah,
I'd be interested to know, what do you, how do you rate the standard of discussion at the select committee? And do you think that they're doing a good job of holding David Davis to account? Do you think they've got a good grasp of what's going on, is basically what I'm asking?
I think they do have a good grasp of what's going on. I think there's a good range of people there to question him. You know, Henry Ruben's doing a good job, tends to open it up with quite a difficult question. The problem is that, first of all, I mean, I think Ben said today, in the last hour, Davis was just basically telling them that he got another meeting to go to and needed to go, so they needed to wrap it up. And Ben came back saying, well, if you were here more often, you know, we could have shorter sessions. So I think the problem is probably more on David Davis' side, in that he's getting quite adept at avoiding the hard questions. But I think the panel itself do quite well in the questioning of him. Yeah, obviously some of them have got different agendas to the others. We saw Jacob Rees-Mogg today giving him a very hard time over the transition period and asking whether we're going to become a vassal state. Which is, we've spoken about the position that we're going to put ourselves in before, and so I completely understand his reasoning there. He even asked David Davis, why are we not just extending Article 50, like, be honest about it. He hadn't really got a comeback. I think Davis's main comeback was that the plan is still that during the transition period we will be allowed to go and do trade deals with third countries.
What is the advantage of extending Article 50 compared to the transitional phase?
Legally it's standstill.
Yeah.
It's a genuine technical legal standstill, so absolutely nothing changes. Where essentially the challenge with the transition is you want to enable an outcome which is absolutely identical, but you're going to have to do that through new legal structures. Untried and untested legal structures. So the UK will need to be treated by the EU and all of its third parties as if it were still a member, without sort of getting into WTO issues of, well, isn't that an exception to the rule of most favoured nation and all that sort of stuff. So it would just make everything simpler. We are staying in all but name. And also, of course, the status quo would mean we keep our representation. So the UK government retains its seat on the European Council. So the European Council. Our MEPs retain their votes, all of that kind of stuff, where in the as we understand it now, the sensible transition is we would lose all of that representation.
Well, Rees-Mogg put that question to Davis today, and Davis's response was that, I think he said, on average it takes new rules and regs about 22 months on average to come into enforcement. So if the transition period is only going to be about that length anyway, there should be nothing coming into force during that period which we haven't already had a say and agreed upon. And Rees-Mogg, I don't think, was particularly happy with that as an answer. But it's interesting to see today that even, you know, the hardest of hard Brexiteers like Rees-Mogg are saying, well, essentially, if this is the transition arrangement you're asking for, then what's the point? Why don't we just extend out Article 50, making the same arguments that we would? I think probably the reason that the government is so reluctant to go down that path is that it's going to be seen by a lot of people as a massive opportunity to stop the whole thing from happening.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, the other technical bit actually just remembered, is the challenge, of course, is we can't negotiate a free trade agreement with Europe until we are not a member.
That's legally so
because you or can't because
else.
Yeah, yeah, because we're not a third country, so we can't. But we can't even prep the EU trade deal while we're still in the EU.
This is
kind of meaningless.
A little bit of a red herring. It's like when we say they've not discussed something, you know, subject X or subject Y. Mm. We know they are actually thinking about it and discussing it behind the scenes. They literally just can't do it.
Can't do anything about it, as it were, practically. Yeah.
Just to go back then, the CBI.
CBI.
What have they said?
They came out with a piece over the weekend essentially saying the UK should remain in the customs union for at least the foreseeable future, if not longer. That raised a lot of heads because it's the first time, I think, one of the big business organisations has come out absolutely in favour of one of the, you know, multiple pillars which make up sort of the EU structures and said we should do this, rather than kind of hedging around saying, well, you know, benefits of the single market or benefits of customs union or common commercial policy or anything like that. So a huge call, which has all of a sudden kind of sent a lot of the newspaper journalists and commentators back to their notepads just to remind themselves actually what the customs union is and why it's important or not important and what does it do. Because essentially most people have just talked about the customs union as being the thing which stops you signing your own trade deals.
Yeah, which isn't true.
No. Do you want to explain a bit about that?
Yeah.
I enjoy doing this to him. It's fun.
I've also just been reading some stuff because I know I've been through all this before, but you have to constantly remind yourself.
Very diligent.
Definitions, yeah, and things. So the first issue with the CBI announcement is that it's once again confusing the customs union with a customs union.
Yeah.
Because In the end of March 2019, we're leaving the EU, and by definition, we are leaving the EU customs union. Like, it's tied up into EU treaties. We can't do anything about it. We're coming out of the EU customs union. So what the CBI is really asking is that we set up a new customs union arrangement that is exactly replicated. Yeah.
So a UK EU customs union.
And you know, there is certainly precedent for that happening. I mean, people also make the mistake of saying that Turkey's in the customs union when it isn't. It's got its own customs union arrangement with the EU, which covers particular sectors and things like that. But if you go to the Turkish border, there are still lots and lots of checks because many areas of the economy are not covered by that customs union. I think customs unions historically are very often tied to political union, and I think that's one of the reasons why the hard levers were always so adamant that we needed to come out of this. But the EU customs union has kind of over time been turned into something much less impactful than it was originally. So lots of people have this idea that the customs union is what is largely responsible for frictionless trade and removal of border checks and things like that, when in reality it isn't. It's much more to do with the combination of the customs union and the single market. The customs union, really in a nutshell, is there to remove tariffs when EU countries are trading amongst themselves. Also, it enforces the common external tariff around the EU, and it also gets around the problem of rules of origin. I think those are the three key things, and anything else which people say that the customs union is responsible for is probably better attributed to the single market rather than the customs union.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I would have said, for the record. Just out of interest, CBI, you guys in CBI must have a lot of crossover.
We work with them mostly at a regional level. They're a regional kind of structure body rather than anything else. So we talk to their Northwest guys quite a lot, and yeah, we sit on panels with them, you know, at a national level. Yeah.
How does their view as an organisation differ from your view as an organisation?
They can probably be a bit more essentially pro-EU. They're a bit more on the pro-Remain side, just because that's their membership. So their membership is much more skewed towards very large international corporations than the Chamber of Commerce membership is. So I think they said their members were something like 75% in favour of Remain, whereas ours came in at 55% in the last vote. So that gives them a sort of slightly different perspective on the world, really.
I have seen people suggesting that the CBI is calling for the customs union because the customs union benefits big business, and helps big business get one over on the SMEs. Well, I don't think that's actually their reasoning.
I'm not sure. I think there'll be aspects of that, certainly, but I wouldn't treat it as gospel. But I guess the bit that comes out of this, John, is when Alex touched on rules of origin, which is a sort of
That's the key one.
This is the really important part. So there's been a couple of good research papers out in the past few weeks. One of which talks about the fact that only about half of UK exports are what we call capital goods. So essentially, the product is finished. So we send a fully fledged something out of the UK.
Now, this is from who? Which organisation has...
Off the top of my head, I can't remember. It might have been the IFS. It might have been UK and the EU. I can't remember. So only about half are finished. So that means essentially about half of our exports are what we would call intermediate goods.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going off to somewhere else to have more things done to them.
So when you say that, do you mean...
products which are semi-made.
Exactly, that's it.
Not components.
Well, they might be. Yeah, that's it. They might. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
An engine for a car or something.
Exactly, that kind of thing. And then for the other report then was specifically looking at the automotive sector. So, of course, we know the UK is one of the largest automotive exporters in the world, supplying huge volumes of output for the EU, one of our big exports. Only about 25% of the value of a car made in a UK car plant originates in the UK. So what that means essentially, of course, is for example, this may or may not be true. For example, the Nissan Sunderland plant is bringing in engines from Germany, it's bringing in wheels from Italy, etc., etc. Of course, there is value addition in the UK as all that's put together, but it's only about 25%. Mm. Now, that really matters if you're outside the customs union.
Now, there are things you can do here, aren't there? Now, this isn't a specific point, but there is a lot of, say, making a car overseas or a product overseas, just have it bolted together over here in order to have it made in the UK, quote unquote.
You could say that, certainly. Yeah, it will be hard to get at any sort of specific issues on that. But the rules of origin bit's important. So as Alex said, this is one of the kind of the big issues in a customs union. So people have said, let's go back to some of our Brexiteer comments, we could go to the nuttier side, which says Germany is always going to want to buy its BMW's offers, because why wouldn't it? So we don't need to worry about tariffs, because there will be a free trade agreement. And actually, on the sense that there will be a free trade agreement, I'd say that's pretty likely. It's kind of hard to imagine that we wouldn't at least keep a zero tariff regime. Problem is, most free trade agreements, if not all, have a rule of origin set of regulations in there, which essentially means usually a majority, I think it's 55% in a lot of the EU ones, about 55% of the value add of the product has to be made within that country to be able to attract the preferential rate, the zero tariff rate. So essentially, a car assembled at Nissan, which has got 75% of its value add coming from within the EU, or outside the UK, let's just say, would not therefore be eligible for preferential tariffs going into the EU market.
That sounds like a horrifically complex process.
It is, and the documentation for it is a nightmare. Actually, you might want to pick up a bit on that. You were talking about it earlier.
We've started going around to some of our members who have to deal with this kind of thing to try and learn from them, the troubles that they face and what their thoughts are on this. So we went out to a big manufacturing company just a couple of weeks ago to speak to them about this. And the whole dilemma for them is essentially whether it's worth going through the trouble of doing all these rules of origin, calculations and documentation in order to achieve that preferential access to certain markets. And it's something which companies like them constantly have to toss up. And so what this leads to is that I've been reading recently that the impact of free trade agreements. So, Liam Fox's big thing in all this is that we want to be able to go and sign free trade agreements with third countries, and that it's going to be a new kind of international trade regime for the UK and blah, 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 blah. But the benefit to economies of free trade agreements and the take-up of routing goods through free trade agreements by businesses is actually a hell of a lot lower than most people expect.
Mm.
I think the impacts of some of the big free trade agreements, it's some of them are coming in at, under 1%, overall benefit to the economy.
The big one that everyone shouts about is the UK can now get a free trade agreement with the US. The modelling suggests the benefit might be about 0.4% of GDP.
Really?
That's all you're looking at.
And again, not particularly linked to Brexit, but there's not that many encouraging signs out of the US at the moment. In fact, the first time I can remember in a long time, they've actually levied tariffs on
absolutely
things.
Hugely protected his country at the best of times. Yeah. Even under kind of the open, even under kind of Reagan and Obama administrations, it was a protection. It was more protectionist than most. Mm-hmm. Under the current administration, it's build a wall.
On washing machines now or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the impact of these free trade agreements is low, a lot lower than most people expect. I mean, even the ones which do really well, it's coming in under 5%, let's say. So going back to the rules of origin thing, the problem with this is that one of the reasons why take-up by businesses of putting their goods through these preferential free trade agreements is the fact that they then have to deal with this rules of origin stipulation. So they have to work out a way of figuring out exactly how much value of each product was added
and
where.
Also,
and then they have to provide the documentation, which is very complicated, to prove that in order to achieve the preferential tariff rates or whatever preference that the free trade agreement is giving them.
And of course, I think the challenge, of course, is this shuttles up the supply chain in a way people don't think. Because people say, oh, well, Nissan can afford to do all of that stuff. It knows what it's adding. It does, but of course, it will buy very specific components from very small manufacturers. Well, who specialise in one very, very small niche. And it's perfectly plausible that the people who are doing that, the smaller work, the S of the SME in their supply chain, they probably don't consider themselves exporters because they're only selling to UK companies. But it'll be those S of the SMEs who will now be asked in the future by the Nissans of this world, can you provide documentation on where the rules of origin of all of your raw materials are coming from?
So the other thing I'm sort of thinking that I'm completely wrong, and if I am completely wrong, please tell me immediately. But doesn't it? Yeah, sure you will. Doesn't it almost disincentivise being efficient? Because the less value that you add, that's clearly going to have a knock on elsewhere in the supply chain.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's sort of the challenge. So the supply, one of the things we talked about when people push back and say, "Look, anyone can. You don't need to be in the EU. Lots of other successful countries aren't in the customs union. We don't need to be there." The point is, of course, is all of these supply chains have arranged themselves over the past 25 years, certainly post single market. The customs union, of course, goes back to the 60s. On the basis that all this is possible. So passing what we called before intermediate goods across countries, it's the equivalent of having a national border in the middle of your factory. Passing that is not a problem under a customs union. Outside of customs union, it's huge. It doesn't happen across other national borders because it's really hard.
Yeah.
So the in this sense, the customs union does allow you to have a single factory which spans up to 28 countries without any of the hassle. That wouldn't, outside the customs union, that is not where those things would have been put.
So it does sound like it's a little bit too early to tell, but has your initial consultation with your members thrown up any unexpected answers?
Well, I think Alex touched on the nice one, which is that there's a big question about whether you even attempt for preferential. Because imagine the tariff on for the automotive industry is 4%, because they don't hit the rules of origin markers. So there's a few things you can do. You can either try and repatriate more of your supply chain into the UK.
Is this the new trendy word, reshoring?
Yeah, you could reshore your supply chain to get the value above that. That's possible. It won't happen. It cannot happen quickly. And for some components, there is simply absolutely no competence in those areas in the within the UK manufacturing base. They've been based in other countries for a very, very long time. You wouldn't get it. So that can happen over a very long period of time. So that would get you over the rules of origin hurdle. Or you actually say, you know what, we've done all the numbers and we think complying with the rules of origin checks is probably going to cost us about 7% overall. Well, actually, the tariff's only 4. Sod it, just pay the tariff. It's just easier. At which point, you don't really need the FTA is kind of pointless because nobody's using it.
The other thing which struck me from one of the visits that we did was that we have to talk about companies which operate just in time, supply chains and things like that. But what about companies who have to hold old stock? Like they have to hold stock ready to repair, old machinery, things like that. If they've got warehouses full of, a mix of new stock which is just in time and old stock which is there to repair old stuff, and then they've got to export that under a new system where they need to provide rules of origin, they've then got to go and figure out what proportion of that old stock which might have been sitting there for 20 years in order to figure that out,
half the companies who made it aren't there
anymore. It's basically impossible to figure that stuff out. So you've either got to go through your entire warehouse, go through every single bit which you're going to sell and figure it out and provide the documentation for all of it, or you just say it's not worth it, screw it, we'll avoid routing all this through the free trade agreement, which really brings into question
why bother.
The benefit of doing all these new free trade agreements, obviously the intention of the government is to somehow grandfather the ones which we've currently got with the EU. When Liam Fox goes on about the fact that signing all these new free trade agreements is going to, you know, boost GDP by massive amounts and revitalise the economy, all the evidence suggests that the impacts of these things are much, much lower than.
Yeah. And this will apply to new FTAs, because we talked specifically really about the EU stuff, but this is about those new ones that, you know, we go out and sign. You know, he was out talking to the massive economy of Mongolia this week.
A little helps,
as some supermarkets tell you. The challenge then, of course, is because we're this intermediate manufacturer, the UK economy on the whole is an intermediate manufacturer. We don't make much stuff from raw materials or components that were made in the UK. Actually, the question then is actually how much of UK manufacturing could ever trigger a rule of origin clause in a third-party FTA? Actually, very little, because we've allowed our supply chain to disperse across the EU, and that doesn't matter.
Amazing.
In the customs union. But outside the customs union, all of a sudden it does matter. So actually, the question about how much, whilst you wait for the entire engineering supply chain to relocate itself, bearing in mind it could go one of two ways. It's either onshores here or offshores there.
It's pretty black and white.
Yeah.
It's pretty black and white. Well, talking about crossing borders, we've had a cross-border visit by a certain President Macron. Do you think his trip was a success for Anglo-Franco relations?
This is on you, Alex. I've not seen a great deal about this.
I honestly haven't seen a great deal about it either. All I've seen is that he said some things which, again, were just a bit confusing and didn't make a whole lot of sense. And this is perhaps another thing which we can dwell on for a little bit, is that the EU constantly goes on about the fact that the four freedoms are indivisible, and also about the fact that we cannot cherry pick. I think the conversation with Macron brought some of that into question, because what he said was, whatever agreement we end up having, it's going to be bespoke.
Yeah.
It's going to be bespoke for the UK. And I think even if we go down, you know, the Norway option, what people say is the off-the-shelf option, it will be configured to be specific to the UK. Whatever route we go down, it will be bespoke.
Yeah.
It's not going to be exactly the same as any other arrangement.
Yeah, because if we're not cherry-picking, someone else is cherry picking. I mean, it's almost by definition. That's how it works.
Yeah, and I think that's it. I think we may have sort of slightly confused this against some of our previous language, where we've reinforced, you know, and the EU too, where you say, look, there is a CETA option, the Canada agreement. There is the Norway option. That's going to be your choice. Of course, those are fuzzy things. So I think there will basically be a choice between something that looks like CETA, a free trade agreement in goods with a little bit of extra stuff, or something that looks like Norway, which is basically four freedoms but tweaked. I don't think there's probably much more on the table than those, but each of those is relatively fuzzy. Because you can't apply the Norway Icelandic model to the UK economy. It would be insane. There would be additional stuff going on.
Well, I mean, the only thing I can add to this is I thought he was very EU with his approach, which was these are the rules and that will be that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, there's always been that desire from the EU27 to maintain unity, you know, over and above anything else. That strikes, you know, it's something our cabinet could learn from.
Did he not also say that he thinks the French people would have voted out?
Yes, he did. That's right.
I read this, but I didn't know if that was in context.
No, I think so. I think, you know, I remember seeing an article or two about this. Yeah, I think he said, you know, what would, you know, why wouldn't you do the same thing in France? Because if we did, they'd vote to leave. Which is kind of odd, because you may actually, you know, from CAP particularly, the agricultural policy, yeah, France is the single biggest beneficiary.
Well, I do think it's also odd that a national leader would say, oh yeah, I mean, I know that's what the people want, but this is what they're going to get.
Don't bloody well ask them. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, we've seen that that referendums over here are a roaring success.
I think it's the old barrister's line about never ever ask any question that you don't already know the answer to.
Yes. Yeah. I quite like the tapestry, and yeah. Yeah, we'll leave it there. Now, you mentioned the Norway option. I think we mentioned the Norway option every week. I tell you what, we haven't mentioned the Jersey option.
Yes. This is kind of going back to the whole rules of origin, customs union thing.
Now, just before you answer this, where has it come from?
The term the Jersey option was coined by a guy called Sam Lowe, who is a trade expert. He currently works for, there's an online group of trade experts which is called the UK Trade Forum, I think. Mm-hmm. It's only become a thing recently, but they're really all really, really good people to follow into it. He also has recently taken up a post at the Centre for European Reform, So he's my go-to guy, I would say, on Twitter on trade issues.
Right.
So he coined the term the jersey option as a bit of a joke, but it's now starting to be taken quite seriously as an option, and they're talking about it across the channel. And so him and another guy I can't remember the name of, I'll have to apologise to that person, released a piece of research from the Centre for European Reform on what the jersey option is and whether it's a possibility. And I'm not an expert, but essentially, jersey is a crown dependency with the EU, kind of like Guernsey. And
yeah, with the UK. Yeah.
Right. So crown dependency of the EU.
Of the UK.
Of the UK.
So, I was going to say, because I know about protectorates, I know about crown dependencies, but it's a protectorate of the UK within the EU, is what I'm going to say.
Well, this is the thing, I'm talking about stuff I'm not an expert.
They are not part of the European Union.
That's the point, is that Jersey, Guernsey, all these places, they're not members of the EU, but they are de facto a member of the single market and the customs union.
Ooh.
For goods. Now, and for goods only, which is the big point. So they're not members of the EU.
Now, this blows my mind, right?
Yeah.
Because quite a few places are members of the single market for goods, but not services. And all of these places seem to have remarkably robust service-based economies.
Yeah, that's kind of one of the arguments that they make. So what they're suggesting is that we could step into a similar position to Jersey or Guernsey or wherever, whereby we are still full members of the single market and the customs union, but only for goods.
Right.
I mean, the first thing to say is, the single market has always been renowned for not being great in terms of services coverage. And obviously, everyone will agree that the UK has massive advantage in terms of services. And so the argument that they're making is that this is an arrangement which might be able to suit everyone. Because it allows us to stay in the single market and the customs union in terms of goods, so we get around, you know, the rules of origin thing, everything that we've just been talking about. It'll please people like the CBI. Companies that export goods can do so on exactly the same terms that they are today. But because we would not be covering services under that, it allows us to have some kind of wiggle room with the EU in terms of actually dividing those four freedoms, essentially.
Exactly, you take one of only four.
And
yes, that's it.
So their suggestion is that by taking freedom of movement of goods but not services, we might also be able to reform freedom of movement of people.
That's right. Yeah, no, the Channel Islands and the Isle of Man are the famous ones in the UK, of course, closest to us. But so, yeah, of the four freedoms, they're only signatories to the freedom of goods.
Yes.
So services, people and capital does not apply.
So actually, they are divisible.
This is what we're discovering.
I think this is it, but don't forget, this is all, you've got to put this in context about how all this stuff came in. So a lot of this stuff was fudged in 73 to get the UK in.
Yeah.
Essentially. I guess the question is, how much appetite does the EU have to refudge in its current guise? So, you know, this was the European Community back in 72, 73. UK and Ireland entered together. How do you handle these things? We kind of fudge it. Because, I mean, the other one, of course, is Switzerland. You know, the Switzerland's position is not that of Norway. It's not an EEA member. It's a fudged issue, primarily because Switzerland said, we don't want to join. But the Swiss government and most of the EU saw the benefits, so they fudged it. What I guess some of the messaging we've had from the EU in the last year or so is, it's not really up for reenacting some of this stuff because actually it causes problems. It makes life really hard.
I mean, it can't which get is much pr- which is probably than how
not,
it is.
Well, it's probably not an issue for an economy the size of Jersey because at the EU scale, at the political relevance scale, it's kind of irrelevant.
Mm.
Whether that's plausible for a £1.7 trillion economy.
I guess where it falls down is the perception of value of these freedoms. The UK obviously does value freedom of capital, freedom of goods, so on and so forth. Now, I don't have the statistics to back it up, but if I was going to have a random stab in the dark, I would say the value of freedom of movement is far more valuable to people on the continent because they speak many more languages, whereas speak one language.
I think that's a reasonable point, actually. And I think it's always been one of the challenges in the UK-EU relationship politically, is essentially, you're right, EU 27 workers are better able to take advantage of the UK than the other way around, purely because, was it only 3% of UK citizens speak a second language?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't work in Spain or France. Well, yeah, yeah. I could if they were all speaking English.
Yes, exactly.
So I probably could, actually. But
so we'll go back to the judge option. There's some terminology which I've missed, which apparently has been mentioned by Theresa May, which is the three baskets approach. So this apparently is the current strategy which the government is seriously considering looking into. So we've spoken in previous weeks about the whole issue of regulatory convergence or divergence, whether we continue to fully align ourselves with the rules and regs of the EU, you know, getting over issues like the Irish border thing and, you know, all that, or whether we choose to diverge, which is what all the Brexiteers want, but then that brings its own problems. And so the approach, which apparently is being discussed in Whitehall and is being termed the three baskets approach, is an approach where certain parts of the economy remain fully harmonised and fully aligned with the EU. Other parts of the economy, we diverge, I think what they're calling is managed diversion, I think, mm-hmm. something like that.
I've heard that before.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in those sectors of the economy, we would be allowed to diverge, but it would still be a two-way thing between us and the EU, so that the enforcement of the rules and regs could still happen as it does today. So essentially, we could agree that we're going to diverge in these particular ways, in these particular sectors. The EU would agree to that, and so there would be no implication for things moving across borders.
It's almost like a reverse accession.
That's basket number. That's right. So that's basket number two, and then basket number three are other areas of the economy where we fully diverge and can do whatever we want. And so,
that'd be fishing or something.
Yeah, I mean that would be a good example. So fisheries and agriculture are the big two which people tend to think of. Again, this is. I don't know how much research has been done on this. It strikes me as a very, very, very problematic approach. We've spoken about the problems that the Swiss have with trying to do that kind of thing. You know, how do you choose which parts of the economy you diverge? Is that, you know, you're going to start seeing things about favouritism of particular sectors of the economy?
I mean, you know, probably.
Yeah, it strikes me as something which might be a nightmare to agree and a nightmare to manage. And it's not something which I think that the EU would agree to.
I guess the only people talking about favouritism of the economy are people who are not in particularly fashionable industries.
Well, I think this is something you would probably agree with. It comes down to the whole argument about industrial strategies, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
It essentially becomes the fact that the government is almost trying to manage the economy. Which
never goes well.
Yeah, and I mean, that's besides the whole problems it might cause in terms of the ongoing relationship with the EU. This whole Jersey option suggestion is basically a way of turning that into something which might be workable, which is that you entirely separate goods and services and we remain fully harmonised and aligned in terms of goods, but in terms of services we can do whatever we want. And so it's kind of an attempt to turn this three baskets thing into something which might be workable. Other implications of this, though, would be that if we remain fully harmonised in terms of goods, that does bring in fisheries and agriculture, so they would have to still go as they are today, which is a big issue for a lot of people. The second one is that we wouldn't be able to go and do our own third country trade agreements in terms of goods. We would be able to go and negotiate new agreements in terms of services.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they've done a significant piece of research into the possibility of this. Their opinion is that the EU would be willing to talk about such an arrangement, but it's got its own problems. Obviously, it doesn't solve everything.
Sounds like a bit of a basket case. With which, unless either of you got anything else to add, we might just leave it there.
Well, I might just throw one little thing in.
Intrigued.
Which we were going to talk at the beginning and didn't.
I'm always intrigued when you go quiet and you go tapping on your laptop.
Yeah,
most
of it's just looking up Crown Dependencies and some of the detail a bit more. But actually, so Alex has spelled it out very well. The one, of course, aspect where Crown Dependencies, at least the Channel Islands, are separate is they are outside the EU VAT area.
Ah.
Aha, you asked about
this. Yeah, so I didn't get an answer.
just a little leapers back there. So again, actually, there's been a lot of confusion here because people think that VAT is part of the single market or it's part of the customs union. It's not part of any of those things. VAT is, there is a VAT area as well. All of the EU is in it. some non-EU countries are also in it. And the VAT thing has kind of raised its head over the Christmas period, really. Again, we've talked before about journalists suddenly hooking on to aspects. So the big thing for VAT is what it does is the UK being outside the EU VAT area because of our heavy trade there has big cash flow implications for companies, which we're starting to work up to. Mm-hmm. So essentially at the moment, if a UK company imports some products from within the EU, they are treated for VAT in exactly the same way as anything you purchase within the UK. Sorry, it's treated for VAT. So you buy it, you do whatever you do, you charge VAT on you sell it, and then when it's all done, you pass the VAT bit back to HMRC. Mm. Outside the VAT area, VAT would become an import tax.
Yes.
So the VAT due on goods as you buy them in would need to be paid at the border.
So this is now a big question in the United States whether they bring in an import tax.
Exactly. So at the moment, you see, a company can bring goods in but doesn't have to pay the VAT at the point of entry into the UK. It just pays it through its normal VAT accounting scheme. Mm. Outside the VAT area, it would have to pay immediately. Now, depending on where those are in the supply chain, of course, it might be several months before you actually realise the income off the product that you bought. So it doesn't have any net overall P&L impact, but it does have a huge cash flow.
Yes.
And for some businesses, particularly some of those big traders, we're looking at numbers that might have 7, 8, 9 noughts a year after them.
Goodness me. So is there an easy workaround this?
We stay within the EU VAT. As always, these things, you stay within the EU VAT area.
Excellent.
So it's just another of those technical things that I said. It raised its head. Everyone got totally excited in the newspapers for about 48 hours, and it's now gone away again. But right. Companies are increasingly asking about all this.
Well, before I let you go, there is one more thing, and this is just kind of a bit of fun. But I like looking at tweets. I like looking at politicians' tweets in particular. And this one's from the immutable Daniel Hannan. Unemployment falls again. More people are in work than ever before, and borrowing is falling. Exports rising, the stock exchange at record high, manufacturing surging, etc., etc. If you're still gloomy, it's because you really want to be. Tell me, is he wrong or is he right? Deconstruct that.
He's not wrong, but there's aspects that sort of need playing through some of that stuff. So quite a lot of what he talks about being positive is essentially currency movement effects.
Mm.
So stock market is high primarily because of weak sterling. That's still buoying things up because, is it, 60% of the income of FTSE 100 countries is companies
somewhere else, isn't
it? Earned overseas. So as you repatriate it back through a weaker sterling, that increases the net.
And also, I think there's other things, isn't there, like HSBC might have a couple of office blocks in Hong Kong
So that's doing the work of that. Manufacturing's doing well primarily because of strong exports, and the strong exports are doing well primarily because of two reasons. One is currency devaluation in the UK. Secondly, growth in the markets to which we sell has responded very, very well in the last 6 or 9 months. So actually, EU growth is looking pretty good at the moment, particularly from the core Eurozone. Germany, France, Spain are all posting pretty good growth figures. So actually, America's picking up. So yeah, the world economy generally is looking pretty good at the moment. That's a big surprise for lots of macroeconomists who were sort of scurrying back to their models and trying to work out what's going on. So that's most of the pickup in all of those things is due to those two effects. UK economy, we've had some better than expected numbers for UK growth. ONS thinks 1.8. I think the bank and IMF think it'll probably come out around 1.5. I think we've said 1.6, I think, in the last month for 2017. They're better than we expected, but they're not great numbers. And the big thing for us is, you know, look under the hood. Yes, we might be growing about 1.6% a year. Trend growth is 2.4. So we're somewhat below our normal expectations. But growth in GDP per capita, how much each of us is worth of all that, is rattling along at just under 1%.
Why is there a discrepancy?
Essentially, the population's growing rapidly.
Brilliant.
That's the main one. So, you know, we've got the rapidly aging population. So growth of over 65s particularly is high. So, and you know, growth rates of the population generally, more the number of children per capita being born, birth rates are up, so all of those things have a downward pressure on GDP per capita. But our GDP per capita figures in the UK have been pretty terrible for a long time, and it's not a number that's really been ever sort of caught the imagination. Everyone likes GDP, but the only thing that makes each of us wealthier is what happens when you divide it by the number of people.
I see.
So he's right in all the things he states are correct. The other thing we don't know is
the point of the tweet is to annoy people, you know, annoy remainers really. He hasn't said that, but yeah, that's what he's trying
exactly
to do.
I agree. Yeah,
that's most of what he does. And I think
he's rather good at it.
Go back to probably what we said in the first episode of the podcast, that Brexit hasn't happened yet. There might not be any reason to be particularly gloomy about where we are now. I think the people who are gloomy are probably more gloomy about the future than the current state of affairs. I just think it's a tweet trying to annoy people, to be honest.
Yeah. So, to summarise, we're getting richer because our money's worth less.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
There you go. Succinct. Right, we will see you next week with more Last Week in Brexit. In the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter. I'm at Jay Beardmore. Give us your Twitter accounts, please, gents.
I'm at GMCC _ Christian.
And I'm at GMCC _ Alex.
Fantastic. Right, see you next week.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.